Well, I have a lot of questions to ask you about fire in heaven, but I want to ask some questions about you. You sound like an awfully interesting guy who's been in an awful lot of places. And where were you born?
I was born in the Midwest.
Whereabouts?
In Moline, Illinois, which is hardly a very interesting place as far as being exotic is concerned. And I was raised there, and I joined the Merchant Marine when I was 17, and that started my career in Asia.
Oh, that took you over there, right?
Took me over there, and then after
that... What year was that?
Oh, that was a long time ago. I think it was 1946 or something like that, 47, just after the war. And then I joined the Army, and after that...
Jeez.
Our Army.
Didn't know if you had joined the warlords.
No, and I was stationed in Japan as a medic.
Why did you join the Army?
Well, I don't know. I had a wanderlust. After I got out of the Merchant Marine, I had a year of college. I went to Yale and decided to just go back into military service. And I was in the Army for a couple of years.
You were not a divinity student at Yale?
No. No, I wasn't. I know why you asked that, because one of the characters of the book is. And then after I got out, I finished Yale, and then I joined the Navy.
Now, when did you get out of Yale?
It was in 52, I think it was. And then I joined the Army. Joined the Navy, rather, at that point. And I was on a cruiser. And I was a navigator on a cruiser, and then I was on a command ship, and all of this.
Why did you join the Navy?
Well, once again, I mean, I joined the Naval Reserve after the Army, and there was a likelihood that I would be taken back. So this time, I decided I wouldn't be an enlisted man. I would go to Officer's Candidate School, which I did. Then I got out and. Off and away I was again to the Pacific.
What did you study at Yale?
I studied philosophy and American studies, of all things, which has had very little to do with my life since then. Then later on, I went back and got a Ph.D.
At Yale?
No, I went to NYU for that,
mm-hmm.
in 18th century English literature.
Mm-hmm.
And then I returned to Asia as a Fulbright lecturer, where I spent 2 years in India. And then I lectured for the State Department throughout Asia. And then I was invited by the Chinese to lecture in China. And so that took another 3 years of my life. So really... I've been associated with Asian things since I was 17, really.
At what point did you find yourself compelled, and I use the word probably accurately, compelled to become a writer?
Well, that was when I was about 15. I was a schoolboy athlete and got hurt. My foot was severely mangled in a factory accident where I was working during the summer. And so I had a lot of time in bed and a lot of recovery time. And I started to write poetry about how I felt. And I was hooked. So since then, I've always written.
Did you grow up in a literary household in Moline?
No, not at all.
What did your father do?
My father was a stockbroker who lost all his money in the Depression and then had to fight back through it. And he wanted me to be a doctor. So I started at Yale as a pre-med student. And as a matter of fact, my highest marks were in zoology, and an arachnologist there, a very famous student of spiders, asked me to be a student of his, with the potential later on of becoming an arachnologist too. But all these things fell by the wayside because I had this wanderlust to go back constantly to the East and to continue writing.
Were you doing well? You were in the Merchant Marines. See if I have the chronology straight. You were in the Merchant Marines. You were in went to Yale for a year. Mm-hmm. You joined the Army. Back to Yale.
Yes.
You joined the Navy. At what point did you start writing during this this period of a combination of military and travel lust? Or were you doing any writing during this time?
Well, yes, I was constantly writing, but I wasn't publishing anything. I was extremely naive about that sort of thing. It was only after I got out of the Navy that my first book was published, and it was about the exodus of the North Vietnamese to the South, the Catholic refugees. And that was The Journey of Thao Kim Nam, which was my first novel, and then that started me off.
Your work has been directed at the Far East, I assume, the preponderance of your work.
Preponderance, yes. Although now I'm writing a novel which centers around the reaction of the medieval community to the introduction of mechanical clocks into the cities in 14th century Europe. But in general, yes, I'm going back. I've been studying Indonesian and Malaysian languages to go back to that, to Southeast Asia, for about a year, presumably next year.
In fact, I'm having a mental block. You know who it is. She wrote Many Splendid Things.
Oh, yes.
I did an interview with her two years ago.
Yeah.
What is her name? I don't know why I'm having the block.
I'm lost.
But I'll before you go, it'll pop into my mind. But her last novel was just about that, about the introduction of mechanical items, automata, this sort of thing, from Europe to the Orient.
I didn't even know that.
Yes, I'll get the name of the book. Mm. And she shows how it was introduced, how these mechanical objects were introduced as toys. And she said that the Mandarins and the Chinese officials looked upon these as toys, did not realize their potential.
Well, it's interesting. Certainly the finest clocks made in the world until the introduction of the mechanical clock into Europe in the 14th century was the Chinese water clock, the most accurate and the most skillfully designed.
You were in India for 2 years, is that correct?
Yes.
As a Fulbright
lecturer? Yes.
But the other trips that you took to the Far East, did you ever live there outside of living for 2 years in India? Or did you actually live in China or these other places? Or did you
extensive visits.
Mm-hmm.
The one in China was about 5 months, and then I returned for 2 months in 83 to do some research for Fire in Heaven.
Mm-hmm.
But I intend, when I go back to Indonesia, to live there for about a year.
When you you went back in 83 to do some research for Fire in Heaven, but were you able to go into China after the revolution at all? Before that time?
Before the revolution? You mean the Cultural Revolution?
Right.
No.
I know Westerners were...
No, Westerners. When I think some Frenchmen got in, and that was about it. Or unless you had Marxist-Leninist credentials.
So your
visits
to China had been before 1948.
And in 1980, I went back to China, as I said, to lecture there. under the auspices of the Chinese government. As a matter of fact, I was the first American novelist to be invited. The reason I was invited is that they had heard me lecture elsewhere in Asia and thought that what I had to say would be interesting to Chinese students.
What did you lecture on?
Well, interestingly enough, I lectured on contemporary American prose, fiction, primarily on Faulkner. And I was astonished at the verbal skills of the Chinese then. And, of course, since then it's been borne out, since there are now 10,000 Chinese students in America from the mainland. They are marvelous linguists, I suppose, because they work very hard at it.
Are the Chinese up on American literature?
Not as they should be, but they will be eventually. They're going to be up on American football pretty soon too, because I understand from a Chinese friend of mine, who was over there at the time of the Super Bowl, that the Super Bowl was televised extensively throughout China. In spite of the fact that the Chinese know nothing about American football, I would assume within a year they will.
We will corrupt them yet.
Indeed we will.
you now live in New York City, is that correct?
Yes.
And you are currently teaching here.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, I teach at the Center for Worker Education, which is part of the City University system. And it's a fascinating program because it's designed for people who didn't have the opportunity, for whatever reason, to go to college when they were young. So there are secretaries and firemen and minor executives without college degrees who want college degrees. This is not an adult education program. This is a degree-oriented program. And I've been involved with it for about 5 years, and I find it extraordinarily stimulating because of the best students I've ever seen.
Do you also teach in the creative writing department?
No.
I think they listed you at one time as a member of the faculty there.
Maybe they might have done so, but I never taught any courses in it because I'm loath to teach creative writing courses. I think creative writing is something you do on your own, first of all. Secondly, you learn by making mistakes, not by people pointing out what you should do. You learn by falling on your face. And the most important thing is that if you take creative writing courses, you're taking time away from reading, which next to writing itself is the most important thing for a writer to do, is to read. And from my point of view, if you want to write and you're going to college, the best thing to take is academic courses rather than creative writing courses, and do your writing on your own time.
Well, to their credit, I believe if a student seeks to get a master of, a master of fine arts with an emphasis on creative writing, he actually is studying English. The reason I know, not just creative writing, there are creative writing courses, but it's heavily weighted toward various English classes.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I know is that a couple of years ago, I thought I would go ahead and try to get a master's, something I'd never done. My mother wanted me to get a master's when I got out of college in journalism, and I was too anxious to get into the field. And now, if I were to get a master's, I would not get it in journalism, but I would probably do it in some form of English. So my company would pay 80% of the tuition, and mm-hmm. because they're geared for people like myself, many of the courses are at night.
Mm-hmm.
And they give you 3 years. And so I thought this would be something that I would be interested in doing. So I applied and was accepted and reluctantly decided not to go ahead with it because of so many other commitments. But anyway, that's how I know a little bit about
mm-hmm.
How they had set up that program, and also why I know that they had been at that time using your name as
yeah.
being on their faculty. So
the creative writing.
Yeah. So your name was familiar to me way back then.
I see.
So that's why
They were using my name in vain, right?
Well, you're not the only one. They have Grace Paley.
Yes, well, she does teach in the creative writing program. That's fair enough.
It looked pretty good. But I didn't do it. Might get. You never can tell. Let's talk a little bit about The Warlord and Fire in Heaven. As I was reading Fire in Heaven, I found it pretty easy to figure out the plot of The Warlord because you gave me some education by flashbacks and this sort of thing. In fact, I was well into Fire in Heaven, and when I went out and I bought The Warlord because I wanted to find out more about it. But just reading Fire in Heaven alone, I think I could probably pretty well tell you the plot of The Warlord.
Well, I hope so. That's what I was trying to do.
Yeah, you don't leave the reader stranded. There were a couple of things that, well, there were a number of things that I really liked, especially in the early part of the book, your descriptions of street scenes and marketplaces. I mean, they're really wonderful, and I think that the only way that you could do that is to actually have seen these. I don't think there's any substitute, and those were particularly good. One thing, I like Philip Emery as a character who's kind of a flawed hero. One thing that I was puzzled about, I don't want to give away the ending, I won't do this on the air, but you could perhaps comment on it, at least for me. I wasn't sure that Philip was actually killed off. Now, you didn't actually say that he has the wound in the stomach like his friend Harry, right?
Yes.
To the end. You didn't actually say that Philip died. I mean, you...
I said he breathed a while and then
but
well,
you did say that. Let's see if I can find it here.
Had I not been clear on that score, that
what
was a mistake
against,
of mine.
Yeah, breathes in and breathes out a while longer than is still. Well, I mean, he could have been just a pause or something. I mean, you did leave the door open that he could come back. But
that was a failure in the sentence structure, believe me.
Well,
because I meant that he was gone.
No, you decided to write him out completely.
Oh, absolutely.
Because I'd expected that Vera would die because she has the heart ailment. And this would pave the way for a confirmation of the relationship between Philip and Sonia.
Mm-hmm.
Would make everything all right, I mean, after she's out of the picture. So you did have a cliffhanger here. As I near the end, I said, there's a real cliffhanger here. I've read all of this book so far, and will Philip connect somewhere in China with Sonia? And what's going to happen next? So what you've done, even though you've killed Philip off, darn it, you have still paved the way for another installment, and I assume that you have started to work on this.
Well, I haven't started to work on it yet because I have these two other projects in mind, one having to deal with Indonesia and the other having to dealing with medieval clocks in Europe. But eventually, I will probably... take up the themes again and make this a trilogy, but I'm not ready to do it yet. I want to really get away from the characters and the situation for a while and come back to it fresh, because I put in 5 years with this concept in the two novels and these characters, and I feel I should return to it with a fresh view. What I was interested in up to this point, of course, is to indicate how the colonial characters, the Western characters in the, particularly in Fire and Heaven, tend to circle back into the past. So much of what has happened before determines their attitudes and their behavior in the present. On the other hand, the Asian characters in Fire and Heaven, at any rate, are beginning to to break out into more action, less introspection, less looking back towards tradition, and with a greater desire for self-fulfillment and independence. And then in the third book of the trilogy, I would tend to focus primarily on the Asian characters, not on the colonial mind, and indicate how they are shaping the contemporary Asia. So there is that thematic attitude that runs through, will run through the trilogy when I eventually finish it.
What is it like working all these years so intimately with all of these characters in this part of the world? Is it an exhausting preoccupation that you have here? Is something you said you just got away from a little bit to work on two other projects? But what's it like when you finish up something as big and as sprawling as that, where you work with these characters day after day after day?
Well, for one thing, I stopped dreaming about them. I mean, literal dreams. I used to dream about these characters as if they were people down the street, you know. So I was relieved of those dreams. On the other hand, I was extremely depressed, because it was as if I had removed myself from a place where I had lived intensely, and I was no longer seeing old friends and bitter enemies. And so for two or three months, I ran around in a very grouchy mood, wondering what to do, now, because I'd lost part of my life.
After, you're talking about after?
After it was finally finished.
Yeah, that's probably, yeah, I can see that. It's
because it was so long. I mean, I've written other novels that I didn't become that deeply involved in, because the writing of those books didn't take as long, so I wasn't as intimately involved in the lives of those characters in the other novels. But in these, I certainly was.
How, when you were writing these novels, how did you compartmentalize your life in terms of writing, traveling, and teaching?
Well, from my point of view, I think what a novelist needs more than anything else is a kind of slow, dumb bulldog determination, which comes out in kind of brutal discipline. I just worked at it every day, no matter what happened, in the rest of my life. And when I say kind of dumb and brutish, I think really that's what it is, because a novelist is a long-distance runner, and not necessarily the brightest of people, but certainly among the most persistent and determined to go on with it. So whatever happened to be on the slate for my days was pushed aside. Unfortunately, my wife and child can attest to that. And I made time every day, 7 days a week.
When you began The Warlord, did you see this story becoming as massive? Did you see this story becoming ultimately a trilogy?
When I started The Warlord, no. But when I had moved through about a third of the writing, I realized that there was more to it than the one novel. Although I approached the idea of a sequel and possibly a trilogy with great trepidation, because there are a lot of commercial reasons why not to do sequels. But I didn't think about that, because I just swept it aside, because I realized that I really had this to say, and I had so much to say that I couldn't do it in one novel. It would take at least one more, and probably two more, because I wanted chronologically to move through Asia. If I stopped with the one novel, then it would leave an imperfect picture of what I conceive to be Asia.
Did you have any difficulty in selling Simon and Schuster on a sequel. And I've heard the publishers complain that sequels never tend to do as well
as the
original book.
That's right. No, they said do what you want, but with a slightly dubious tone in certain voices, I must say. And so I did what I wanted to do.
Well, it's a novel. It has just about everything in it: action and sex and color and sweep. And it's certainly it's a wonderful read. And I enjoyed it enough to. I had not read The Warlord previously, but I enjoyed it enough to go out and buy a copy of The Warlord because I wanted. You know, I think that one of the greatest compliments someone like myself can give a writer is, I want more. I want more. You know, I didn't want it to stop. In fact, when I got to the end, I wanted more.
That is indeed a great compliment, Don, and I thank you for it.
Well, you're certainly an interesting guy. Oh, there was something in, before you go, something in some of the publicity material that struck my interest. It's something called Tai Chao Chuan?
Tai Chi Chuan.
Uh-huh. Say that again?
Tai Chi Chuan.
All right. That just kind of struck me as kind of interesting. What is that exactly?
Well, it's an ancient Chinese exercise, which incidentally I'm going to be demonstrating on television. Unfortunately, since this is radio, I can't really show you how it works. But it's been practiced in China for about maybe 1500 years, so it's relatively new to Chinese culture. It is practiced today in China. When I was in Shanghai, for example, I joined the morning group on the Bund, and I had immediately about 200 people gathered around to watch this Westerner do their exercise. I started to practice it about 15 years ago. I was interested in the martial arts, and this is, in a sense, a source for many of the martial arts, including karate and kung fu. There are four kinds, but I do the Yung style, which is the most classical, although not the most difficult. And it's a series of 108 movements, which are done at a very, very slow pace. You shift weight from one leg to another very, very slowly. You move very slowly. Every movement you make is supposed to be circular, not angular. You breathe in and out in a certain pattern, very, very slowly and very, very deeply. The sequence of the movements are fiendishly complicated, so that if you don't concentrate totally on the exercise, you forget where you are. You cannot do the exercise without total concentration. And if you practice it, it takes approximately 15 minutes. To do the exercise. If you do it, say, in the morning and the evening, and you start to do it on a very regular, intense basis, there are moments when you have the sensation of leaving your body in the same way that you do if you meditate. And I've done both. I've studied yoga, and I've done a lot of meditation, and I've had the same effect in doing Tai Chi Chuan that I have had during meditation. So it's rightly so, because it was initially devised by Taoist monks who were becoming very sedentary in their monasteries, and they started to do these exercises at a very slow pace to get some circulation going. It's a wonderful exercise for people who are essentially sedentary, or who are elderly, or who are recuperating from an illness, because it's relaxing. When you get done, you feel calm and peaceful, and that's the benefit of it. I've seen 90, 95-year-old Chinese do it, and they're as supple as a young girl. really.
I don't know. I'm the kind of guy who gets bored on an exercise bike. I don't know if I can.
Well, that's what I use now most of the time, I must admit.
You strike me as the kind of guy who probably be more at home in a restaurant in Chinatown than in Elaine's.
Yes. How true. Well, I cook Chinese, and I also cook Indonesian.
Mm-hmm. Rice stoffel?
I can do some rice stoffel dishes. I'm not really very. I'm not an expert, but I can.
It's like rice stoffel would take you 2 weeks to cook.
Well, that's a real job. I mean, that's, you know, 2 days a rice stoffel job. But I like to cook Chinese.
You have a set of woks.
Oh yes, I have all the stuff.
Where have you learned to cook?
Well, I've taken classes, two different sets at the China Institute, and I've taken at the Asia Society under Chinese cooks. Incidentally, when I started to study Tai Chi Chuan, I studied at the China Institute under Dao Lu, who was a very famous teacher of the exercise. And to go back to that just for a moment, I must say that about 3/4 of the class were black belts in all the martial arts, Aikido, Kung Fu, so forth. And they were going back to the real source, the energy source of all of those wild, violent exercises, and doing this very calm, deceptively simple one.
You really have a preoccupation with the Far East, don't you?
Oh, I do, yes.
That's the Tao since the... It's been ingrained in you since 1946, since your first trip over there.
Well, yes. Yes, there was something about it. I just felt that I had gone home. And I never have that sense in Europe at all. When I'm in Europe, I'm an American in Europe, and there's a vast distinction between me and what I'm seeing. But there's something about Asia, particularly India, I must say, which makes me feel that I've been here before, that I belong here, and that I'm comfortable here. And I seem to live at a faster, more excited pace in Asia than I do here. I'm more of a lizard in New York than I am there.
I just did an interview last Friday with Ved Mehta. Do you read his material?
Yes.
Very fine.
He's marvelous.
Wonderful writer. Do you believe that the... I hate to pursue this because we're really out of time, but just another question. The communist government in China, now you've been there a couple times now, what have they done to destroy, what have they done, if anything, to destroy the ancient traditions of China?
Well, I can tell you... a first-hand experience about that. I went to Khufu with some Chinese friends to the cemetery of Confucius, and the stela, the monument, stone monument there, had been broken to pieces by Red Guards who came down from Beijing in a kind of zealot frenzy. And they brought down pickaxes and sledgehammers, and they went through the cemetery. They also went through the Confucian temple grounds, where they had ancient stelas which are 2,000, 3,000 years old, and smashed them to smithereens. The destruction to the cultural treasures of China is incalculable because of the Cultural Revolution. Incalculable. On the other hand, the government now is attempting to salvage what they can. A lot of those stelas have been put back together again, the ones that they could do that to, although they destroyed literally thousands in that one area. For that reason, there are not as many cultural things to see in China as you would expect. As a matter of fact, there's a paucity of them. I'm amazed just how little there is. And most of it can be attributed to what happened during the Cultural Revolution. Now, however, Confucius is once again, if not worshipped, at least respected by the Chinese people. And this is a political move because during the Cultural Revolution, Zhou Enlai was equated with Confucius. And so by the Gang of Four and by Mao. In other words, they were, by discrediting Confucius, they discredited Zhou Enlai. That's the way the Chinese mind operates sometimes. And since then, of course, with Mao out of the picture and with the reemergence of Zhou Enlai as a great Chinese leader, Confucius too has been resurrected. And when Confucius is resurrected, then all the cultural artifacts of ancient China are also repaired and put back on display.
When did you say, you said you were going back, didn't you?
I'm going back in 87, in Malaysia and Indonesia primarily.
Mm-hmm. Will you be, is this going to be a research journey, or will you be...
Well, I'm going to stay, I'll live there in that area at least a year, and I'll lecture, I hope, under the auspices of the State Department again, under a special program. And I'm going to try to find out various things about what is happening in those two areas because so little is known about them, which is one reason why I'm trying to learn the languages in those two areas. They're related, Malaysian dialects and Indonesian. But you really can't learn anything unless you get out of the cities and find out what's really happening, particularly in Indonesia.
Have you learned the Chinese language?
A little.
So many dialects.
To get
Chinese,
around, yeah. I can get around.
I understand there's so many dialects that even Chinese in various areas of the country don't understand each other.
That's absolutely true. The Cantonese cannot talk at all to the people from Beijing. What they do, they write out their answers because the written language is the same. But the spoken language is entirely different. It would be like German and Spanish. It would be like German and Spanish, but the Spaniards and the Germans had a language in common, which would be English, that they could write, but they couldn't speak it between them. So if a Cantonese goes to Beijing and he wants directions, he writes it down.
That's the classical name for Peking, right? Beijing.
Yes.
Well, you're certainly an interesting guy, Malcolm Bossy, and I like Fire in Heaven an awful lot, and I wish you the best on your travels and your exercises, and it was a pleasure meeting you.
It was a pleasure being here, Don. Thank you.
And I'm sorry that you had to come shell-shocked from your tax man.
Yes, indeed.
Would you hang on just a second?
Sure.